Warning, you are about to listen to the greatest radio show ever. And due to contractual obligations and to shield our airwaves and corporate licensees from any semblance of liability, responsibility, and gullibility, we must tell you the views represented on this show are not necessarily those of this station or its management. This radio show contains differing points of view on current political topics, and due to the nature of its contents, it should be heard by everyone. Thank you for listening. 3, 2, 1. Now live from the Devil Radio Studios in Madison, Wisconsin, where the political party is just beginning. Welcome to the Devil's Advocate Show. Friends proving it's never personal, only politics.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
Here is your host, Mike Crute.
Welcome to the Devil Advocates Radio Show, the Friday happy hour. You know, my little buddy Dom lives for the weekend, but he's already on it. He's, I guess he's an excused absence back on Tuesday, but, you know, he's never quite excused. So instead, I got to find Code Devil, who's joining me right now. Want to thank my most recent guest, first and foremost, CEO of Civic Media, my partner, Sage Weil. Thank you, Sage, for laying out your vision for 2023. And welcome back to the returning champ, former U.S. attorney, host of Morning Cannoli, Saturday mornings right here on the Civic Media Network, 9 to 11 a.m. James Santel, the incomparable. How you doing, counselor?
Neither a champ nor incomparable, but delighted to be with you again this afternoon, Mike.
Man, you got a new haircut. You're looking quite...
I do have a... It got a little short this time, but... You know, it's the kind of the lawyer look, right, for January of 2023.
You're looking quite handsome, counselor. Breaking news. Recently breaking. New to me, at least, and you probably researched this, counselor, but I'm going to throw it out there. The E. Jean Carroll defamation lawsuit against the former president, Donald Trump, and she accused him of raping her in a Bergstrom's department store many years ago. And during the political campaign, Trump said effectively, never happened, she's lying, and she filed a defamation lawsuit. Now, my understanding, the original lawsuit was dismissed. Is that the correct sequence of events?
It was, through some machinations of the prior administration having to do with the Federal Tort Claims Act and whether it comes into federal court. And so if, in fact, the original lawsuit was subject to a ruling on whether or not the United States of America is substituted for Donald Trump, then it would be dismissed. So it's a little bit complicated under the jurisdiction, but you're right. We've got even more action even since that.
Well, and the depositions taken of the former president, they've been released. They've been unsealed. The Trump team was supposed to be responsive to the court in like 3 days. There is a new legal challenge under what, New York's sexual assault law, that effectively there's no statute of limitation. So while this was originally a civil defamation suit under this newer New York law, it's really a rape case, is it not, Jim?
Yes. And so we've got a separate, again, the other one, arguably state case, arguably federal. This, again, under this new law that basically captures for a period of 1 year those people whose statute of limitations would otherwise expire. It permits claims to be filed. And that's what E. Jean Carroll did fairly recently, just the fall of last year, under this new theory, under this new New York law that really does permit her to resurrect an assault claim, which is different from the civil defamation claim. Again, also prompted, however, by the former president's repeated statements in the public domain that this never happened, which, again, doesn't help if you're looking to avoid lawsuits. So we do have both of those still pending. And then it's inside all of this that his recent deposition transcript ordered by the district court judge in the other case that is a deposition transcript now released about what he says and does not say about what happened at that in the 90s. At that Bergdorf Goodman store.
Well, I don't know about the complete transcripts, but the very first question asked of the former president, according to reporting at Politico at this hour, effectively got tripped up. They asked him about the E. Jean Carroll book. She was a writer. She published a book. And they asked him about the publisher, and he's like, bad publisher. Well, who is the publisher? I don't know. Well, the publisher was HarperCollins. Still a bad publisher. Well, the publisher, HarperCollins, published your son-in-law, Jared Kushner's book. Well, they still publish a lot of bad books as well. I mean, this is how it began, Jim. I have not had any opportunity to jump in and read any of the transcripts. Have you seen any further reporting, any additional points where the former president got tripped up, let's say?
Right. I have not. Also, just breaking, as you say, that the again, the transcript released by virtue of this judicial order here. The difficulty, of course, is that the former president now under oath and obliged to answer questions in this civil setting. And the complication here, and again, I haven't seen all of this transcript yet, is that because he is now facing some criminal exposure in the other lawsuit, the question is, did he raise the Fifth Amendment? What kinds of things did he say? And plainly confronting the questions of E. Jean Carroll's attorneys about what happened. And my general sense from seeing some of the reporting here is quite pointed and quite specific. We'll have to kind of revisit the exact statements that he made after there's further digesting of all this. But it certainly complicates his criminal exposure, his civil exposure, a lot of things going on here. All of it, because when he was in the White House, he decided to take her on and say, you know what? As you said, she's a liar. This never happened. Again, as we've talked so many times before, if he had simply said nothing at all, probably all this would have gone away. We'd have some articles out there and that would be it. He is in many ways his own worst enemies when it comes to these things that he says in public. Now he's in double trouble, and we'll take another look at the transcript as we get more into that document.
Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Finest of guests, James Santel, former U.S. attorney. More importantly, he is the host of Morning Cannolis. Give him a taste every Saturday morning, 9 to 11 a.m. all across the Civic Media Network. Replayed Sunday mornings at the same time. Well, Jim, there is some other big news on the legal front. A special counselor appointed by Merrick Garland to investigate not Donald Trump, but the current president for his own, as I would probably term them, paperwork crimes. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, what do you know about the special counselor, Robert Hur, other than the fact that he's a Trump holdover?
Right. Absolutely. So former U.S. attorney in Maryland, and again, a Trump nominee, a Trump appointee, served a little while most recently at the law firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, which is a very reputable law firm there in Washington, D.C., other places, and was previously, of course, inside the Department of Justice, inside the operation, the leadership of the department, a graduate of Stanford Law School, Harvard College. We recall well that Rod Rosenstein was our former deputy attorney general. This fellow, Mr. Hur, former U.S. Attorney Hur, served as one of his principal deputies during that period of time. So he plainly has credentials. He has been a prosecutor for a while. He's got some civil experience. And again, the attorney general has plucked him up, again, to follow up on his decision to appoint a special prosecutor. Undeniably, as he has been doing recently, reaching across the aisle to find a Republican so that he is avoiding the claim, the allegation, the charge that this is, whatever the decision is made, it's a product of partisan views and partisan viewpoints here. So that's who Hur is. Again, beyond that, I'm sure we'll chat about this more. Significant differences, as the media and others are saying, between what we know about the Biden case and what we know about the Mar-a-Lago Trump case. But nonetheless, the kind of thing that Merrick Garland has got to be saying, gosh, I don't need this kind of additional investigative work to do. I've just got to be focused on what I've got on my docket already.
Jim Santel, my fine guest. Jim, let's talk about the differences. I was going there next. You led me. I have been quick to dismiss the paperwork crimes, as you've heard me describe them, against the former president, Donald Trump, despite the classified nature, despite the voluminous nature, because I have thought there are probably more specific in more significant criminality that the former president was guilty of. It's not that I think he should get away with it. It's that if he is charged, indicted with some crime on the federal level, I think Jack Smith, the special counselor, should really be looking at the January 6th activities.
Yes.
But here we find our guy, my guy, Joe Biden, the guy I voted for, the guy I've been rooting for, at minimum being very sloppy, setting a very bad optic. And then when it's two sets of documents, you got him in the garage out by the Corvette. I mean, you got to take flack from guys like Peter Doocy from Fox News. So, Jim, obviously the optics for the current president, they're awful. But there are quite a bit and significant differences between the two men and how they responded and their conduct. So please help differentiate between the paperwork crimes of the former and the paperwork crimes right. of the current.
Right. Concurrence right off the top with you and your perspective that Jack Smith should be focusing on January 6th. And hopefully sometime soon we'll be on this radio broadcast to talk about the return of a grand jury indictment as to those kinds of offenses. As to this one, you're absolutely right. Remember that the matter involving Mar-a-Lago was going on for months, well over a year. Repeated requests from NARA, the National Archives folks, to return these documents, a grand jury subpoena that was not fully complied with, ultimately a search warrant when it became clear that the documents weren't there. What does that all show? That all shows notice on the part of the former president and intent to keep the documents, right? That's one of the big differences here.
Give them back. They're mine, Jim. Give them back.
There you go. Right. Here, what you have, of course, is, again, taking the media's reports at their word, you've got the discovery of these documents, both in the office or in Washington, D.C., and then also in Delaware, the disclosure of them right away, even before there's any reasonable probable cause to believe, if you will, that they're sitting there. And again, that reflects what? That reflects a lack of intent to do something illegal. And that's the reason why the broad takeaway here is highly unlikely this is going to lead to a criminal prosecution as opposed to what's going on with Donald Trump side of things.
Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. A very talented lawyer, my friend James Santel. He does his own show. You better not be holding back the good stuff, Jim. Morning cannolis each Saturday morning right here on the Civic Media Network, 9 to 11. But we ain't done with you yet. Please stick around, James Santel. Everyone, stick around. More Devil's Advocates.
Honest, I ran out of gas. I had a flat tire. I didn't have enough money for cab fare. My tux didn't come.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
The Devil's Advocates, radio for the 99%.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates radio show. We got the finest of guests. He is Jim Santel, host of Morning Cannolis. Every Saturday morning right here on Civic Media, you should be setting your alarm clock, getting up and listening. Listen to him, and then I think the Badgers tip off at noon tomorrow. Jim, appreciate you making some time for the big show this afternoon. And, Jim, there's so much legal news, but nothing, you know, has really been brought to closure. We don't have any closure on any of these issues. So I continue to watch, especially Fulton County, Georgia, Fannie Willis. And we understand the grand jury, the state level grand jury, has come to closure. And we understand the something about like 25, 26 grand jury members, by a preponderance, by more than half, wanted their information, their report released to the public. And there's going to be a public hearing on January 24th. And hopefully, Jim, at that time, we'll know more. But between now and then, could we see criminal indictments? Could that grand jury have recommended criminal indictments against the former president? And when would we know? When would they drop? Can't hear you, Jim. Did you mute yourself, fella? There you are. You're back.
Okay, very good. All right.
When will we know about the indictments in Georgia, Jim?
There you go. Very good. So this was a special grand jury. And again, I don't purport to be an expert in the legal criminal procedure in the state of Georgia, but special grand jury plainly taking evidence presented by the district attorney there, Fannie Willis, for a number of months here. We've seen a lot of reporting about who's testifying there, all being compelled to testify. Those people have been contesting those subpoenas, and they've come to the come to the end of their work. And under the procedures there in Georgia, this special grand jury does not, as I understand it, have the capacity to return an indictment. Nonetheless, they do have findings, and they presumably have delivered those now to the district attorney, who, again, as I understand the procedure there, can now present these to an indicting grand jury and present all this information, doesn't have to go back to square one. That's the procedure there. And so, depending upon Fannie Willis's burning the midnight oil, getting these other things in place, it is entirely possible that we are coming to the end of that pre-trial, pre-charging procedure, and a new grand jury there in Fulton County taking on the work of this special grand jury could now return an indictment, again, focused upon what happened in Georgia, but especially focused upon the attempts by the president and his cohorts to try to affect the election there, the results of the 2020 election. 11,780 votes, that request of the Secretary of State, all of that focused on this, but also more broadly. She plainly was focusing on many things related to the election there, and all of that could come out, I believe, virtually any time now. It'd be interesting to see. She may, in fact, be somewhat opposed to having the release of all this before that decision is made for a variety of different reasons, but there is a time yet between now and the hearing. That could happen at any time, as I understand procedure there. And we could see some very significant news coming out of Georgia. And more beyond that narrow point, important point, but a narrow point nonetheless, it may well be that this could be among the most important criminal prosecutions of the former president and other people surrounding him. Why? Because this one could survive beyond a Biden administration. This one's not subject to pardon authority by a future president. And if Fannie Willis and the grand jury there indict, this one could in fact go to trial and go to conviction and presumably an appellate ruling supporting that conviction. We have talked before about the timing concerns right now with Merrick Garland indicting, Jack Smith indicting, and the problems with basically 22 months or so getting all of that done during this first term of the Biden administration. So again, the focus that you have, Mike, upon Georgia and about what Fannie Willis is doing cannot be overstated. And this may be the one that we're all looking at, not only very soon, but also historically.
Jim, you pointed out your expertise are in the federal courts, but why the redundancy of grand juries? Why must you bring one to closure and then what? Turn around and present the findings of this grand jury to the next? How does that part work? And does the second grand jury bring the indictments, or are they already recommended? And why can't Fannie Willis act upon the findings of the first grand jury?
Sure. As I understand it, once again, it is a vagary. It is an aspect of Georgia criminal procedural law. Every state has some differences. Not all states have grand juries, those kinds of things. And that's the way they do it there. Plainly, we've got a different federal system where we've got one grand jury that takes information, takes testimony, and then can also return a grand jury indictment, that same group. It certainly seems to make a whole lot more coherent, if you will, certainly efficient use of time to do it that way. This is the reality in Georgia. Not to say, however, that it further slows down the process. My sense is that by doing it this way, you've got a grand jury that truly is fact-finding, and their mission, if you will, to the extent that it might suggest that they've got an indicting mission as opposed to a charging mission, the notion here is find out what happened here, give us the facts, and let somebody else, a different grand jury, a different prosecution unit, determine whether or not what you have found in your exploration of the facts supports a grand jury indictment. I suspect it's simply affording defendants and the system generally a greater amount of due process and procedure that, again, strikes those in the federal system, including me, as being a little bit cumbersome, but nonetheless, the way that it can, in fact, result in a charge there out of Georgia.
My fine guest, Jim Santel. Jim, I'm going to ask you to stick around for one more segment. Then we'll keep some time at the end of the show for the airing of the grievances. But I'll at least express the question I have. We talk about the paperwork crimes of Mar-a-Lago. They seem so very obvious. The former president, well, he had the documents. But unfortunately, we also know the current president's got his own paperwork crimes, his own classified documents issue. Jim, I have looked at the case in Georgia predicated on the evidence that is in the public record. And specifically, I mean the phone call. I need 11,780 votes, one more than I have, he said. One more than he needs one more. He needs one more than that to win in the state of Georgia. Well, it was on tape. Come back. Lordy, there was tapes. Our fine guest, James Santel, more of the Happier Happy Hour. You're listening to the Devil's Advocates.
But don't ever take sides with anyone against the family again.
It's not personal.
The big and tall of political talk. The Devil's Advocates.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Friday Happier Happy Hour. It's almost the weekend. We'll get you home safe and informed by our fine guest, James Santel, former U.S. Attorney, host of Morning Cannolis each Saturday morning right here, 9 to 11 Civic Media Network. Jim, I got to tell you, though, as I was sort of spinning the yarn as we were wrapping up the segment, I talked about the public record in Georgia is so very clear.
Yes.
You know, we joke about the lack of a smoking gun in most cases. And you as a lawyer know far clearer than most in the audience, there ain't no smoking gun in most cases. But in this case, it's on the tape. Lordy, there's a smoking gun, Jim, relative to paperwork crimes, as I often describe them, as I... You know, I'm like Ron Johnson, minimizing the crimes of the former president in regards to the classified docs at Mar-a-Lago. Jim, this is so clearly a provable crime. Why has the man not been indicted, convicted, and on third appeal by now?
Right. Isn't that the frustration? And I am increasingly of the same mind, which is this now needs to move. This needs to move, whether it's in Georgia or out of the Department of Justice and the seventh floor of Main Justice in Washington, D.C., you do have something that you very seldom have in what I'm going to call a white-collar, call it paper crimes kind of a case, which you've got the defendant, the putative defendant, the potential defendant here on tape, basically attempting to skew the election. And you can describe that in a number of different ways, federally, statewide. That's what Fannie Willis has. So I have to believe that she is looking at the special grand jury, making a finding, yet there was the intent to do this, purposeful, obviously, to get that additional vote. Why? So that Georgia's electoral votes could swing in his way as opposed to Joe Biden and return him to power, as he said. So you've got a very clear statement there. And not to excuse at all the length of time that this has taken, my sense is that rather than simply charging that very discrete unit and saying, Mr. Trump, you're charged with having attempted to undermine the election here in Georgia by that statement, she expanded this and went beyond that, talked about the visits by Trump allies to Georgia, talked about other things involving the attempts to intimidate election workers there. So my guess is that what the special grand jury has found is not only a violation of the law, even if they don't come right out and indict on that, but also many other activities that were a part of what I'm going to call the Eastman approach on this Eastman memorandum. There were an attempt not only in Georgia, but around the country, including right here in Wisconsin, to undermine the 2020 election. So my prediction, we'll see if it's true or not, is that at some point when we're together, Mike, we're going to be talking about an indictment coming out of Fulton County that, yes, identifies that key element, that 11,780 vote plus one request that is at the core of this. But then beyond that, all sorts of other things, multiple defendants, multiple events, multiple transactions described in an indictment that is fairly sweeping. And I think that's one of the reasons why this is taking so long, is she expanded this, perhaps appropriately, beyond just that narrow smoking gun, as you've described it. At the same time, get back to the fundamental point that you made and that I made as well, which is TikTok. It is now time to do something. And again, as I've expressed before on this fine broadcast, very concerned about the extent to which a federal criminal prosecution right now will be finished in time for the conclusion of a first Biden administration. Elected a second time, then you've got a new lease on life. But the notion that there could be federal pardons by an incoming president, perhaps of a Republican persuasion, could bring all that to an end. Not true. Not true of what's happening in Georgia. Not true what's happening also in New York. Not the civil matter, but the criminal matter. If, in fact, district attorney there in Manhattan pursues some of those things that were the subject of sentencing just this past week, that too could also be the subject of some future prosecution here. So we need to look not just at Merrick Garland and Jack Smith and others, but to these state officials, and they may be the answer here longer term.
Jim Santel, my fine guest, you referenced New York State. My understanding, the Trump org was sentenced, and I realize I've been kind of wrong on this topic before. I thought this was a civil trial, a criminal trial of the Trump org, and a $1.6 million fine, which seems like a lot to a working stiff, but relative to this supposed billionaire's fortune, seems quite insignificant, but it's the max the law allowed in this circumstance, was it not, Jim?
That's exactly right. So that happens today. The state court judge there imposes the maximum. The attorneys for the Trump Corporation were asking for less than that. As many people have observed, $1.6 million, it may not be a drop in the bucket, but it's not that significant. It is the statutory maximum. And so the judge did not have discretion to go beyond that. We know that you can't throw a corporation in jail. But earlier this week, the same judge did send Alan Weisselberg to Rikers Island for a number of months, and he will begin that service by virtue not only of his plea agreement, but his testimony as well. So we've got two criminal convictions coming out of, once again, that state criminal prosecution. An awful lot of reason to believe, following up on my comment before, that Alvin Bragg in this file may not be done. We know he may still be looking at this matter involving trying to pay off people for not testifying about an affair that the president had. That would, again, have to be in time and also have to be related to a state offense there. And again, if that file is still open, we've always speculated that the reason why Alan Weisselberg was indicted first was a hope that he would come forth and testify against his continuing boss in that institution. He plainly hasn't done that. He didn't do it on the stand. He came close, but he did not do that. And so one would like to think, at least, that Alvin Bragg and the assistant DAs there are still looking at other avenues to pursue an indictment against the former president and perhaps others there. This may or may not be the end of that criminal prosecution in the state of New York coming out of Manhattan.
Jim, I saw a couple of snarky responses on the interwebs. Here's one. Finding the Trump org probably less than they paid their attorneys. I suspect there's probably an outstanding invoice larger to the Trump attorneys. Probably got stiffed on the lawyers' bills, at least to date. Here's another one. Tell me what you think about this little sequence. Trump org, tax evasion, Trump University, fraud, Trump Foundation, stealing charity money, Trump hotels, financial crimes, Trump Saves America, wire fraud, Trump campaign finance crimes. Gosh, I wonder if there's a common criminal behind all of these criminal entities. How can all of these Trump-associated entities be guilty, but the guy in charge is somehow the Teflon Don?
It is stunning. And again, I join those who are shaking their heads in abject disbelief that this continues to be out there. Many of those are criminal prosecutions, again, of entities. Many of them are civil prosecutions, bringing to an end, for example, the university. We know as well, if you go across Foley Square and talk with the Attorney General of the state of New York, she's got this $250 million lawsuit against the Trump organizations, Trump companies, and Donald Trump and his children, also for this valuations issue having to do with real estate in Manhattan. And that is going forward as well. That's, again, a civil case, but very likely that at some point, maybe not soon, but some point down the road, that will be added to the list that you just read, Mike, of another situation where she's basically gone after them, stopping them from ever again holding positions in a corporation, a board of directors, that sort of thing. And yet, there needs to be at some point a criminal indictment, a criminal charge somewhere that says Donald John Trump, comma, defendant, right? And that's whether it's a state prosecution, a federal prosecution. And as I think you're appropriately indicating, there is frustration that this much fraud, civil fraud, criminal fraud, describe it as you will, does not get to the core person who is at the core of all of this, the head of all of this, and that's Donald Trump. And that's why in the interest of rule of law, in the interest of justice, in the interest of history, our generation this time has got to return criminal charges. They can be discreet. They don't have to be everything coming out of January 6th. I've got here the report. I'm sure you read it top to bottom. It is compelling stuff. You don't have to charge everything out of here, but it has to happen. And it has to happen soon, not only because of the statute of limitations, but because people like you, good people like you and others, deserve to know that the rule of law applies to everybody and that this is not a situation where you can simply continue to do these kinds of things and get away with it as he has done throughout his career.
Folks, you are listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Friday edition, the Happier Happy Hour. I'll make a confession. I've never been to law school. I never took the LSATs. But my fine guest, Jim Santel, he has, and he's a lot smarter than me, and he damn near always gets it right as far as I can tell. So, Jim, got to pull you back to the January 6th report. They did make criminal referrals. Of course, their criminal referrals don't matter. They're irrelevant, except perhaps in history, judging this bipartisan panel, this sub-select committee, choosing to criminally refer the former president of the United States. Well, I have not done the heavy lifting of reading that big book, Jim. I'll let you do the homework and you just tell me. But Rolling Stone has done a deep dive and they found an interesting text. I want to ask you. I look at Georgia and that was effectively Trump and perhaps a few co-conspirators, Mark Meadows, his chief of staff, Lindsey Graham, looking for, you know, give me five dead people, just anything to call fraud and declare a false election. It's clear on their criminality. I'm very clear because I've heard it on tape of Donald Trump's criminality. But the January 6th, this seems like a much broader plot with lots of co-conspirators. And the January 6th committee and the reporting of Rolling Stone pointed out that the Stop the Steal guy, Ellie Alexander, had sent a text message the morning of January 6th as the crowd was on the march towards the Capitol to Paul Gosar, Republican rep from Arizona, who's been prominent in many of these January 6th activities on behalf of MAGA Nation, and said effectively, get out of the building. It's hell out here, and they're coming your way. You know, we're bringing hell with us. Specifically, he told his chief of staff, I think you and your staff should maybe leave. This is hell out here. Jim, does that imply, what does that imply? I don't want to put words in your able mouth,
sure,
counselor.
Right. I mean, superficially, it implies that there's danger, right? This is serious. This is not visitors, tourists at the Capitol. And that's not an unimportant point. Beyond that, the question is, what does it convey about intent? What did you know in advance and as that was happening? Now, the mere identification of a group heading toward the Capitol, some of whom seem to be armed, maybe not with firearms, but with other things, that in and of itself does not convey, incorporate criminal intent. On the other hand, the things that that again are in this report that talk about the amount of, as Liz Cheney would say, the summoning to Washington, D.C., the lighting of the match, those kinds of things. What is your purpose in doing that? And if indeed it is, in fact, to obstruct an official proceeding, false statements, which is the false electors charge, these four things that the committee has sent to Maine Justice identified as crimes, as I look through, and I haven't read every last word, as I look through this report, I see an awful lot of intent, an awful lot of purposeful activity designed, again, to obstruct proceedings. to make these false statements. The false electors portion is very compelling. And all of this, again, presumably before Jack Smith as well, could inform the basis for grand jury indictments against more than just the former president, but many people identified here and presumably also before the federal grand jury investigating this matter now.
He is the host of Morning Cannolis. Leave some cream in the cannoli for tomorrow morning, Jim. Tune in tomorrow morning, 9 to 11, right here on the Civic Media Network, originating from WAUK in the Shaw. Jim Santel, have a wonderful weekend. I'll look forward to listening to your fine show. Thank you for joining us here this Friday afternoon on the Devil's Advocates.
Always a pleasure, Mike. Honored to be with you once again. Have a good weekend. Take care.
Thank you, Jim. Come back with us. One last segment for your grievance this Friday afternoon, 844-96-PARTY.
No, I don't take responsibility at all.
You can't keep getting away with it! You can't keep getting away with it!
Kicking ass and taking names since the Wisconsin uprising. The Devil's Advocates.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the happier happy hour. Rolling on. What a fine guest. James Santel always is. Appreciate it. Jim, don't forget, try his fine program. 2 hours of Jim Santel. That's a lot of cannolis. Morning cannolis right here on the Civic Media Network, 9 to 11. Tune them in. Get the app. All the Patriots have it. Also, your Friday grievances. They're welcome here. Most of you are welcome anyways. Some of you are tolerated. You know who you are, CJ. 844-967-2789. Real quick. I see a Rico. You're first in the queue. But I want to bring up a point, a political point here from the great state of Wisconsin. Molly Beck reporting at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Wisconsin Parole Commission became a major, well, the decisions of the Wisconsin Parole Commission became a political flashpoint in 2022. Now, the Democratic governor here in the great state of Wisconsin, Tony Evers, has named a retired senator to lead it. And it's my guy, John Erpenbach from Middleton, where my family has resided for some time. John has been my senator for some time. I found him very responsive. John was a fixture. I've seen John all around town. But anyways, John has stepped down from the Wisconsin State Senate. And I think this is a great appointment because don't forget, this guy's got to make it through a Senate confirmation process. But let's tell you about his resume. Democratic Governor Tony Evers has appointed a recently retired Democratic state senator to lead the state's parole commission, decisions from which became a focus of Republicans' arguments against giving Evers another term in office. Well, hell, you know, they had to make up something. Former State Senator John Erpenbach, Crudy's guy, a Democrat from West Point outside of Middleton, will serve as the chairman of the commission after 25 years in the state legislature. You're going to not confirm a guy you served with for something like a quarter century? Erpenbach's not qualified for this position? I want to hear how they rationalize it if they don't give him a quick upvote. Anyways, Erpenbach was a member of the legislature's powerful budget writing committee, which tackled issues related to incarceration. Here's what Erpenbach said in a statement. The parole commission plays an incredibly important role in our criminal justice system and in making sure that the system is just, fair, and constructive. The success of the commission depends on our ability to balance the law and public safety while supporting victims, survivors and their families, and keeping dangerous individuals off our streets. It's that balanced, thoughtful approach I intend to take as chair. Erpenbach did not return calls to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Neither did Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu. Devin, you served with John. Is he qualified? I'm taking an early vacation this Friday. Anyways, a little bit more here. What do we got? No, that's that's basically it. The rest of it, less important, just sort of recapping Republicans using the issue of parole in the past.
You same old story. Do. Oh, yeah.
Same old song and dance. 844-967-2789-88. The same old song and dance. It's Rico from Rock County. How you doing, fella?
Oh, doing just great. It's Friday, right? Hey, I got to tell you guys, I got this fresh off the press, brand new. I thought I'd light it up in here tonight. Hey, fresh off the press, never heard before, dad joke. You're going to like it. You're going to love
it. It's a bad joke? Yeah. Okay, and listen, it's bad and it's
no,
new.
It's a dad joke.
Dad joke.
Dad joke. Never oh, okay. heard before. I got it.
Bad joke dad and dad joke jokes are sort before. Of synonymous, aren't they, Rico?
Yeah, but I'm a grandpa, so I do have to admit that. Anyway, listen, here it is. Got it. Hey, I heard on the Matt Flynn show that the Taliban took over Missouri. You did? Yeah, the first thing they did was took away their Second Amendment rights. They did? Yeah, they no longer have the right to bear arms.
Ah, I see what you did there, Rico.
That's it.
Of course, the state of Missouri, I believe Republican lawmakers there said their female colleagues were subject to a differing dress code. They must wear sleeves. The female lawmakers must wear sleeves. And in Missouri, as is the custom, the male Republican lawmakers go sans sleeves, don't they, Rico? Sort of, you know, yeah. wife beater style.
Yeah, normally.
You got anything else other than a bad joke here on a Friday afternoon, Rico?
Yeah. Did you ask me if I had something else?
Yeah, other than...
No, I'm just happy. I'm just happy to be on the greatest radio show. I love listening to Jim there. I check him out every Saturday morning. I called his show last week, too. He knows how I feel about the whole situation. There's the lack of charges and everything else. It's just, there's not even any more. Hey, you know what I take solace is? I just love this little, it's almost like sweet revenge. This Trump, every week he's going to drop a new charge on us. It's like a never-ending movie. And then you got the Republican Party, it's in disarray. Yeah, it's imploding on itself. And every day it's kind of, you know, I take a little solace in that. I like it. I'm watching the show. I got to be optimistic, right? That's why I tell the jokes.
Rico. Stay happy, my friend. This is not great news, but it's Wisconsin-centric. I'll leave you with this thought for the week. GOP congressman displays Christian nationalist flag outside his congressional office. Everyone in your own mind, real quick, think, what Wisconsin congressman would have a white Christian national flag proudly outside his congressional office? And if you thought, Glenn Grossman, you'd be right.
More like Glenn Grossman, am I right?
The former president used to call him Grothman. To the point where I think he started calling himself Grothman, the Trumpiest of Trumpsters. U.S. Rep. Glenn Grossman has a Christian nationalist flag connected to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol displayed outside his congressional office. You make us so proud, Glenn. On Friday morning, Grossman... I almost called him Gableman, sort of similar dudes. Grossman posted a picture of the flag, which shows an image of a pine tree and the phrase, an appeal to heaven on a white background, to his Twitter account with a message inviting people to visit him in the Longworth House office building. With the 118th Congress underway, the People's House is finally reopened to the visitors. If you're in D.C., I encourage you to stop by my office and say hello. And the white flag with a pine tree and the phrase appeal to heaven is visible in the photo placed outside the door. Now, if you didn't know, that's sort of a white nationalist flag. The appeal to heaven flag, which was designed during the American Revolution and used by the Massachusetts Navy, is often associated with George Washington. But it's been appropriated by the white nationalists. Here's a quote. It's a reference to John Locke saying human beings can appeal to government, but at some point you have to appeal to heaven. You have to have a revolution and fight it out. There's a revolutionary, anti-democratic dimension to it. They're saying democracy isn't working, so we have to appeal to heaven for God's will to be done. White nationalist Congressman Glenn Grossman, great state of Wisconsin, you make us so proud. Thank you all for listening to the Devil's Advocates. You're the real patriots. Stick around, Native Roots Radio's next. Hafeman Brothers playing out in Madison. right here on WTTN. Keep it locked, Civic Media. Have a great weekend. Go Badgers.